time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello, and welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for November 3rd, 2018. Yepper, it's November, and man, was that lightning fast. Remember to turn your clocks back tonight, too, if your state does daylight savings time, as we do here in Ohio. As we approach the holidays, I usually try to highlight one possible gift item, and tonight it's power. Unlike heart rate and cadence, power has become a measure of how well you are doing on a very consistent basis. One of the first companies to offer a wireless power system is Stages Cycling. I remember the PowerTap rear hub that required you to have a whole new rear wheel, and it had a rough start with quite a few failures. But then in 2012, the first Stages crank arms were being shipped to customers, and a seamless wireless system has become pretty much mainstream since then. Tonight, I speak with Sean Coffey, who is the Global Marketing Manager for Stages Cycling Outdoors. He'll fill us in on how it works and why it's an important measure of your efforts. Sean will be with me later in the show. My first guest tonight is probably one of the most interesting and courageous people I've ever had the pleasure to interview. A few weeks ago, I received her book, Saving Lucy, A Girl, A Bike, A Street Dog, and I thought, what's this all about? Then I sat down and started the book, and hours later, I finished it in one sitting. Ishbel Rose Holmes pens a tale of a life, hers, that found her homeless and on the streets in Scotland at 16. She also became a British national track champion. She raced for the Iranian national team. And then she decided to sell everything and hit the road, traveling around the world by bike. Today, Ishbel and her blogs, World Bike Girl and IshbelHolmes.com, have thousands of followers. Her adventures are riveting, scary, and heartwarming. And from the girl who had no space in her life or heart for love comes a tale of a street dog named Lucy and a worldwide effort to change how street dogs are treated and cared for. I want to preface the conversation for those who are not familiar with a deep Scottish accent that you might want to slow the interview down or repeat a couple of passages so as not to miss what she has to say. Ishbel begins by telling me she likes my accent. Meet Ishbel Rose Holmes. Hi, Ishbel. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thank you for speaking with me today.
Hello, Diane. Thank you very much for having me on.
Oh, it is absolutely my pleasure. You know, I sat down and read your book cover to cover in one afternoon. I could not put it down.
Yeah. So many people are saying that to me, that they're sitting down to read my book and they're finishing it in the one go or within a couple of days, which I'm surprised about. It's really good.
It is good. It is good. So before we talk about your book, Saving Lucy, can we talk a little bit about World Bike Girl and how it started and what it is?
Yeah, so I began cycling the world solo in 2014. And back then, there wasn't really many people doing it, especially women. And I thought, wow, this is so epic. I'm going to write a book about it. But my English was really bad, even though it's my first and only language. Years of using predictive text and not reading books meant that my spelling, my grammar, my word choice was just horrendous. So I had did high-level sport before, and I had learned from sport that if you want to get better at anything, it's quite simple, actually. You just have to repeat it over and over again. So I began a blog called World Bike Girl as a means to get better at English with the hope that I would be able to write a book. And little did I know that within the first months I would have thousands and thousands of readers of my blog. And that really built a community of people all around the world who were following my adventures around the world. And we've done some amazing things together. When I set off to cycle the world, I just had visions of me, my bike, and the most beautiful landscapes. What I hadn't accounted for was how I was going to react to the world that I was cycling. And I think that's why the bond between myself and the World Bike Girl followers are so strong, is because they genuinely help me in situations around the world with human beings and with street dogs. So it's been incredible, World Bike Girl.
It is an interesting community, and it comes up again and again in the book how it helps you. It's so interesting. So
yeah,
talk to me a second about going back and how you started riding before you decided to go around the world, because you did some pretty high-end racing.
Yeah. So I was actually, before I set off to cycle the world, I was a velodrome sprinter for the Iranian national women's team. And that will come as a shock to your listeners because of my accent. But I was actually, I was born in England, and my mother is Scottish and my father is Iranian. So because of that connection, I was able to ride for the Iranian national team. And before that, I was a velodrome sprinter in Scotland for a couple of years. I road raced as well all around the UK and Ireland. And it really all started when I was 7 years old and I got my first big girl's bike, which was pink, much to my delight. And on the front of the bike was a basket with a teddy bear in it, and I used to cycle my teddy bear around. And I used to ride that bike a lot, but not because I was interested in cycling. It was because I really wanted a horse, but there was no chance I was ever going to get a horse. So I used to ride my bike and pretend it was a horse. And that's how I actually began riding my bike fast, because obviously horses travel fast.
That is so true. You were pretty good at racing too. You became a really fast track sprinter.
I was British Masters champion for the match sprint at one point before I went on to race for Iran. Yeah, I'm just really good on a bike. I've always used the bike as my main mode of transport. I'm 37 years old and I don't actually have a driving license. I've never had one. So, yeah, I'm just really good. And when I was involved in sport, I loved the discipline. I loved the commitment. I was on the Scottish Institute of Sport Gold for Glasgow programme, which was a training programme for the Commonwealth Games. And I learned so much about mindset, which then I applied to the rest of my life. So I absolutely loved what that aspect of sport.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Ishbel Rose Holmes. She's written a book called Saving Lucy, but she's really a lot more than just this book. And some of the things she's done are just amazing. Let's talk a little bit about your early life, because it sort of informs everything that you're doing, and you're still struggling with some things today. So your mom had some problems, let's just put it this way, and it ended up sort of being taken out on you. Tell us what happened and how you ended up out on your own when you were really young.
Yeah, so I basically, as soon as I turned 16 years old, I was thrown out onto the streets. But way before that, social work were involved because my mum believed there was something wrong with me. And social work said there wasn't, psychiatrist said there wasn't, but yeah, it was difficult times. My mum had asked social work to take me away, but they refused. I was a straight A student at school. School was really important to me. I wanted to go to university so as I could study marine biology, and my end goal was to go and stand on a boat in between the whalers and the whales. So that's pretty much an activist. But I didn't know that back then. So, at 16, I was put into foster care. By the time I was 16, I was completely destroyed as a human being. There was nothing left of me. I was a broken mess. And it was this, when I first went into foster care, for months, I just cried every night for hours because I was so horrible. My own family didn't want me. And it was this belief coupled with absolutely having no self-worth and being such a young age that's when my life got really bad. And in foster care, I was targeted by, not very nice people. And by that point, I was thinking more about killing myself than I was about doing my homework and my dreams of university and saving the animals. And I ran away from foster care, basically to keep myself safe. But I was still at school and I still tried to go to school when I was homeless. And just my dream slipped away from me, and I spent the next few years homeless, alone, incredibly unhappy. And then I was 21. I was being thrown out of a unit, being shouted at by the key worker that I would always be in the gutter. And they believed that, I believed that, everyone believed it, that I was just going to be in the gutter of life, of society. And I just thought to myself, I need to make a decision. I was at a crossroads. What is the point in living life when all I want to do is die every day? And I chose life in that moment. And I know people, young people, that didn't choose life. So I'm incredible. I'm just like so thankful and blessed that I did. And it wasn't even a matter of me choosing life and being like a superwoman with the cape on, into a new life. I literally crawled out of the life that I was in. And I tried so hard to achieve my dreams. I went to high level sport, but I was so damaged by my earlier years that I was incapable of love and I was incapable of being loved. And that's pretty much the state that I was in when I set off to cycle the world on my own.
Yeah, which is a pretty exciting journey.
Yeah.
Let's take, you have this bike, which really isn't a round the world bike. You decided to start in, was it Italy?
I started in France.
Oh, in France. I'm sorry. You started in France. And you just started riding. Tell us about the first few days of taking this bike and just riding.
Yeah, so I pretty much sold all my belongings at car boot sales. And I set off with, it was about £250 sterling. And the bike that I had bought, because I didn't have money, it cost me like £300. It was a city bike, so it's a bike that's designed for grabbing a latte with your friends or going to the cinema, certainly not for riding around the world. But that's what I set off on, and it was just really heavily loaded with everything I needed, my tent, my stove, my food, my clothes, and lightweight, small packing equipment costs a lot of money. So you can imagine, I looked like a cycling tank because all my equipment was so big and bulky. And bearing in mind, I pretty much went overnight from being a velodrome sprinter. I was being trained for 500 metres was my maximum distance, and then going to like cycle the world. And I started off in Nice in France because I wanted to start in the sunshine, and it was a £30 flight. It was just, I just looked online and the cheapest flight I could get to the sunshine, because obviously in Scotland it rains a lot, and that's why I started in Nice. And then I started my world tour by cycling the Alps, which was, I hadn't obviously thought that one out because I was on a fully loaded bicycle. My first night of cycling the world, I pitched my tent and I got into my tent hungry, because in the 30 kilograms of luggage that hung from my bicycle, I hadn't even packed a lighter to light my stove. And I remember I was sitting outside my tent and just striking pebbles together, like what you see on the TV that the adventurers do, and being thoroughly disappointed that I couldn't make fire. So I got into my sleeping bed, like a complete failure on my first night. I couldn't even feed myself, thinking, oh, how am I going to cycle the world?
Right.
And then, like, transition between being a velodrome sprinter to a round-the-world cyclist was really painful in the beginning, especially because I was cycling the Alps, which is basically I cycled all the famous climbs that are in the Tour de France. That's how it started. And I remember in my first days, like, some really horrible moments. There was one time a group of geriatrics just jogged on past me. I was cycling as fast as I could up this hill, and a group of geriatrics jogged on past me. Not only that, they were laughing and chatting when they were jogging past me, which was absolutely so destroying for a cyclist.
So it's sort of baptism by fire. You're going to learn or else.
Yeah, yeah. I would definitely advise people to do a couple of weeks training or something.
Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Ishbel Rose Holmes. She is a round-the-world traveler, and she can say that proudly now. She's written a book called Saving Lucy. It is just an incredible book. The story is incredible. Let's find out where you met Lucy. So you began actually pedaling across Turkey, which, you know, I'm not hearing you being afraid the way I think I would be afraid. During the entire book, I'm waiting for you to be terrified, and yet you seem to just get through every single issue with such calmness. You seem to be, I mean, maybe you were terrified, but it doesn't come across in the book. Were you scared?
No. That's one of the best things to come out of my earlier years, because I'd been homeless. And you know, people often say to me, isn't it dangerous to, like, cycle and wild camp around the world on your own? And I just laugh, because nothing has ever came close to being as dangerous as what life was like for me being 16 years old and on the streets of Scotland. So that's one of the strengths that came out of that. So, no, I mean, I deal with situations really, really good and calmly. And I can read people as well. I know if I'm in a dangerous situation. So, yeah, I have irrational fears. So, like, things like spiders and slugs.
Right.
And trolleys, like, I know I'm called an adventurer, but I will run screaming with no control if there's a tiny spider in my tent.
Yeah, I think I understand that one. I think all women understand that one. So there are a couple of terms you use, which I have never heard. Wild camping. What is wild camping?
Yeah, so wild camping is pretty much camping, but not using a campsite. Wild camping is when you really want to be with nature, with the landscape, and you go off and you just pitch your tent wherever, basically. There's obviously, you have to make sure that you tidy up completely after you, that there's no trace of you. Usually, you know, you'll pack up early and be on the road early, so you're not disturbing anybody in the local area. But also, as well as wild camping, I've also done a lot of urban camping as well. So, like, if I've been in towns, I've found, like, a little square of grass to put my... I've even camped in cities, actually, this way. And you know, there's a difference between putting your tent in a campsite with other tents and just having your tent, your stove, and the most amazing, incredible landscapes and being in amongst nature, watching the sunset, cooking your dinner. It's a completely different experience, and I really recommend that people try it out.
Ishbel, can you stay with me? We're going to take a real quick break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to talk about Lucy. Is that good?
Sure.
Okay,
sure.
Hang on a second. I'm speaking with Ishbel Rose Holmes, you're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We'll be right back, and wait till you hear the rest of this story.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Okay, we're back. If you're just joining me, rewind. You need to hear this whole story. I'm speaking with Ishbel Rose Holmes. She wrote a book called Saving Lucy, A Girl, A Bike, A Street Dog. The book is amazing. You will sit down and do what I did, which is just read it until you're done. Tell us about Lucy and about the dogs in Turkey. I found that so interesting how, you know, I mean, I have two dogs in my house and I always have dogs. And yet that's mm-hmm. not the way people in Turkey live. Tell us about what dogs are like in Turkey, and then Lucy. Tell us about Lucy.
Yeah, so, it's not just in Turkey. There's lots of countries that are like this, where dogs aren't actually pets. So dogs have their own identity as dogs, independent of sort of human beings. So, for example, In Britain, a dog doesn't have the right to life if it's not owned by a human, if it doesn't have an owner. But in Turkey, street dogs exist as their own identity. So in the law, a street dog has a right to life and to live in amongst human beings in communities. But obviously, there's a big problem because of population control. Street dogs do suffer. People don't have money to take the street dogs to vets, so if they receive injuries or if they're knocked down, they can suffer. As well, there's a lot of safety stories that have been passed down through the generations, and the reason for these safety stories was because of the high risk of rabies in Turkey, like years ago. And so stories, for example, children would be taught, you know, if you're naughty, the big bad dog is going to come and get you. Or in rural parts, people still believe that if they inhale a dog hair, that's what causes cancer. And it's all these stories that have been created and passed down through the generations to stop people going near, and especially children going near the street dogs because of risk of rabies. But there's not a need now for those stories, but it's going to take another while for it to filter out. So dogs, you know, are not inside the home and homes in Turkey. And there's a belief, there's a lot of belief that dogs are dirty, that dogs being inside a home interferes with the relationship with Allah. But then at the same time, if you look at Britain, we are a nation of dog lovers. We've all got dogs in the home. But, like, most restaurants and cafes or coffee shops will not allow a dog inside the coffee shop. So why is that? Is that because they think that dogs are dirty? So it's the same sort of thing, but it applies to the home.
Interesting. Tell us how Lucy found you.
Yeah, so before I started Cycling the World, I had no interest whatsoever in dogs. If I met you with your dog, I would say hi to you. I wouldn't even acknowledge the dog. I just had absolutely no consciousness about dogs or, you know, interest. And I was cycling. I was actually looking for somewhere to build a fire because I wanted to be more like a real adventurer in my head because I still am an adventurer that runs away from spiders. And this dog started following me. And I knew not to speak to the dog, not to acknowledge it, not to feed it, because the dog would try and run after me and I wasn't interested. I was cycling the world. I was still really goal orientated. I'd just come out of sport. And basically, street dogs were not my problem. So I tried to cycle away from Lucy as fast as possible. And she kept chasing and chasing and chasing. And something inside me just screamed out that what I was doing was wrong, and I stopped. And I thought the best option would be to take her back to where she started following me. And she was attacked by four dogs at the same time. And she didn't try to run away. She didn't try to fight the dog. She just lay down and allowed what was happening to her to happen. And in that moment, it was the first flashback I'd ever had. I had blocked everything out. And it was to a moment when I was 16 years old, and one of the reasons why I ran away from foster care, when I had been the same as this street dog, and I had just like allowed to happen to me what was happening without trying to run away or fighting back. And in that moment, I just threw the bike down and I ran screaming. I was screaming for Lucy, for the street dog, for myself, and I got the dog's offer. And it was in that moment when it was just an instant connection. It was the first time I had ever identified with another soul in my life, even though it was a street dog. And I decided that I would attempt to give Lucy what I had never managed to do in my own life, and that was to have a home and a family. So that was how the journey started with Lucy. I found her a shelter like hundreds of miles away. But because I was in Turkey, I couldn't get anyone to help me with transporting Lucy. So I attached a crate on the front of my bicycle to cycle her into safety.
So it's pretty interesting that this is not a little tiny dog. This is a 45-pound dog. So now you've added another 45 pounds to the front of your bike. And
yes,
some of your description of trying to ride these roads with Lucy are hilarious and scary at the same time. But one of the cool things, one of the things I thought was so interesting was that you were using social media and the response was instantaneous and you started getting help along the way.
Yeah, it was the first time I had used social media. I was basically, I was having a little mini breakdown, as I've had many as I've cycled the world. And I was sitting at the side of the road, like crying. I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it anymore. It was just such a difficult journey with Lucy on the front of the bike. And I posted on Facebook what I was doing, a picture, the road that I was on. You know, if there was any lorries, trucks passing, could we please get a ride? And it was ridiculous because none of my friends, you know, had visited Turkey. I didn't have a large following or anything. And I just stopped crying. And I thought, Ishbel, you know, nobody's coming to help you. If you want to help Lucy, you're going to have to just dry your eyes, get up and keep cycling until you're at the end and Lucy is safe. So that's what I did. And I had no idea as I was cycling that the post was going viral in an incredible way around the world. And everyone was trying to help. I didn't know this. And I ended up with, you know, an animal charity and a news crew turning up outside my tent at 3 a.m. in the morning to take me and Lucy the rest of the way. And that was my first introduction to the power of social media if it's used correctly. And also it was a very strange situation for me as well, because I'd always been like really isolated in my adult life because I'd just been so damaged, fear of abandonment kept me really like alone. And then all of a sudden I had like so many like thousands of people from around the world actually being nice to me and thinking like I was okay, which had a huge effect on me as well.
So if you're just joining me, I am talking with Ishbel Rose Holmes about her book, Saving Lucy. And it's really about Ishbel's life and the way Lucy had impacted it. We're not going to tell you about what happened to Lucy other than the fact that she had some physical problems along the way. But I do want to talk about some of the the things that have happened since all of this, including that you were in Syria, or you got yourself to Syria. This was an interesting thing that sort of changed you, I think, too. And that was visiting the Syrian refugee camps in Turkey, that how you somehow were talking with the people of the resistance. It was just such an incredible story.
Yeah, I didn't actually go inside Syria. I ended up, because I ended up cycling about 1,100 miles with Lucy. After it had went viral, a dog trailer was donated that I attached to the back of my bicycle, and we cycled around Turkey educating people about the value of street dogs, the bond that's possible between humans and dogs, and really, like, educating people, like, not to harm dogs. And we cycled all the way down to Hatay, which is on the Syrian border. And as soon as I sort of, like, cycled past the sign for Hatay, normally if you're doing long-distance cycling, when you get to a big sign that's, you know, somewhere you've been cycling towards, you're really happy, you're taking selfies. And that excitement wasn't there, because I knew there was a war. I knew I was getting near to the war. And, of course, cycling through that area just was heart-wrenching. Cycling past self-made refugee camps, the children just running after me, and I would stop. They would have bare feet. Like, I'd never seen children so dirty. This was before the mass migration across Europe. And at that time, all the official refugee camps over the border were completely full. They were overflowing. So refugees that made it over were forced to sleep in parks, were making their own self-made refugee camps that had no running water, no toilets. It was really hard. And then I felt really guilty every time I wanted to cry or a tear would escape down my cheek. I would feel so guilty because I just felt I had no right to cry, like me coming from Britain. And then, like, what these people and their families and the children had been through, you know, and the children were still smiling. So I bit my lip a lot through there and refused to cry unless I was in my own company. And I would just sob my heart out for these people and what they'd been through and what they were going through.
What did you tell these rebels? How did you get in touch with these resistance sort of fighters? And what did you say to them? It's so interesting. Why did they ask you what they did? And they asked you about saving one dog.
Yeah, so you know, none of this was planned, but the more I was cycling, I think because I was a foreigner and I was a blogger, the people, the refugees, kept asking me to record their stories. And I kept saying, you know, like, look, I'm just cycling the world. I've got a little blog. I'm not a journalist. I'm just a blogger. And they didn't care, because they were all there making the decisions whether to take their families overland and risk being shot, or whether to take their families on the boats and risk being drowned. So they just wanted their stories somewhere. They didn't care if it was on a blog or a newspaper, just so something existed of them, because the chances of them dying were really high. So I started, I use the word interviewing, but it was like chatting. They were asking me to record their stories, and obviously I was asking them questions. And I ended up going to Renali, which that's sort of the entry point, one of the entry points into Syria. And I was there interviewing refugees, and I was taken to a building, and I thought I was going to interview a refugee just like what I had been. And it wasn't. I was taken into, as soon as the door opened, I knew something. I knew I wasn't there to interview a refugee, because all the memory suits, it was like marble interior. I walked in and I was sat down in a room, and all along the side of one wall was the words and the flag of the Syrian Revolution Command Center. And they had a translator, and they were asking me, like, who I worked for, And I just say I'm comfortable in these situations because of my past, and I know just to be myself and just to speak the truth. And I kept saying I'm World Bike Girl, I'm riding my bike around the world, I'm a blogger. And they asked me to tell them about Luffy, the street dog, and this totally threw me and confused me because I thought, why are the head of these departments of the Southern Revolution Command Centre asking me about a street dog? But they were really interested and they wanted to know everything about the journey, about the social media, about the help we got. And then when they explained to me why they were asking, it made sense to me because they said that, you know, I have managed to get the country to care about one street dog, you know, a country where a lot of people don't like street dogs, they don't have any like caring or love for street dogs, and through my social media I'd managed to get them to care. And they wanted to know how I had done it because they said that they had like so many thousands and thousands and thousands of human beings in Syria who were suffering, being tortured, and nobody was listening, nobody was helping. And they wanted me to help them with social media to tell the story in a way that people would actually care around the world, and in the hope that perhaps they would march to the governments and demand that they were helped, the people were helped. So that's what happened there, yeah.
And what was it you told them would make a difference? And I don't know that it has. Obviously, the refugee situation in Europe has shifted and changed, but it doesn't seem like a lot of help is still coming for the Syrians at this point. But you did tell them something.
Yeah, I told them that, you know, there's so much. It's too big for us. When we see it on the news, it's too big for us to comprehend. And we sort of shut off. And I said to them to present the story in a way that we're not shutting off because we do care. It's just that it's too much and we don't know how to help. And so I advised that they use the story of a child like what I had did with using, you know, one street dog, and to watch the language that they were using as well, you know, any language that made it sort of seem like it was religion, anything that was too far away from us that we couldn't relate to.
So what's happened in animal rescue since you wrote your book, since Lucy? Things have changed, actually, in the world of animal rescue because of you.
I don't know about that. To be honest, there are people out there, and, you know, I know them all. You see, I've not them all, but there are people out there that dedicate their whole lives to saving and rescuing the animals, and they are the real heroes, absolutely. And the ones that are too busy to be on social media, you don't really see these heroes, but they exist everywhere in these countries. But, you know, in Turkey, they've got a massive neuter and return program that's going on in the country just now as their way of dealing with the population control. You know, in Britain, our way of dealing with it, one of the most affluent and developed countries in the world, we dealt with it by killing the dogs that didn't have owners. So Turkey has chosen to stay in line with their beliefs that every street dog has a right to life. And that's why they're going with the neuter and return program. And they're also beginning education drives to change people's attitudes towards dogs. So these are long-term programs. And if that is successful, what Turkey managed to achieve with street dogs, then actually they are leaps and bounds ahead of how we dealt with the situation in Britain.
I still say you had something to do with that. You brought it to people's attention.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many people out there. You know, another thing that's changed over the last years is a lot of international attention is on Eastern Europe now. So Romania is a big country. And that's obviously really great and amazing for the difficulties that's happening inside Romania for the street dogs. But a consequence of that that people aren't aware of is that the dog rescue and cat rescue projects around the world in other areas, they don't get the same financial help. So, for example, Brazil. Brazil was by far the worst country that I myself have cycled through when it comes to the treatment of dogs. And that is, I mean, the amount of torture that goes on there with dogs, I've just never came across that before. And, you know, there's no funding from international charities going into Brazil. There's dogs in Brazil there that's run by, it's an English woman and a Portuguese man. And they actually have an adoption centre now in the USA, Dogs in Brazil. But these are people that are having to raise all their money themselves in these places. And they used to receive little bits of funding. But I think we really need to look at distributing the money internationally and the support in a much more even way. Because, like, I just can't believe that there's not help going into Brazil the way it is with the street dogs. I'm in disbelief. And there's so many great organisations out there and people who want to help street dogs, but there's a bit of an imbalance just now in the way that the resources are being allocated.
You know, there's a horrible, horrible festival in China where they torture dogs too. And I have a friend who works really hard to go to China and bring dogs back here and have them adopted out. It's just amazing to me that people are so, they don't see dogs for their value as beings. And it's very upsetting to me. So what are your current goals? What are you doing right now? I know you're going to talk to the head of Scotland this, like tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
Are you excited?
Yes, amazing. It's going to be, it's an amazing opportunity, an amazing experience. And for someone like me, who used to be like homeless and people just walked by me, to now I'm going to speak in front of the First Minister of Scotland.
What are you going to talk about?
I'm going to be talking about my book and about, you know, what I learned about love through the street dogs as I traveled the world. That's what I'll be talking about.
Nice. What are some of your long-term goals, Ishbel?
So for the first time in my adult life, I actually want a home. It's never been something that I've been attracted to, but I really want a home for me and my dog, Maria. So that's a longish term goal. I've already started writing my next book, which is about dogs that I rescued in Brazil. And I am really passionate about advocating for mental health as well and reducing stigma with that. So I've got lots of things that I'm doing, just following my passions and following my dreams.
Do you have a new bike or are you still riding the same bike?
Well, what happened actually, before I went to South America, because I cycled up South America as well, I got a new bike from the manufacturer, Stanforth Bikes. And I actually take photos of that around the world as I'm cycling. And it's my photos that are used on Stanforth Bikes' websites and their brochures, which is totally cool. But I've still got that bike. That bike is still in Turkey and I still visit the same place where I hung out with Lucy every year. So I've still got my bike, my original bike as well.
Well, this has just been such a wonderful experience talking with you. And I have to say that I have to give you so much credit for everything you've done and for saving dogs, which is so near and dear to my heart. And I know a lot of my listeners too. But I do always have three questions and I'm going to ask them to you. What's your favorite food?
My favorite food is sabzi. It's a Persian dish, rice dish.
What is it?
Sabzi. It's a rice dish. The food in Iran is the best I've ever tasted anywhere.
Oh, it's rice. Okay. And what music do you like to listen to?
So I listen to lots of different music, especially traveling around the world. I like British indie a lot, but I love 80s cheesy love songs. Well, I can't believe I've just admitted that.
Cheesy 80s love songs. That's cool. That's cool. Well, I'm not going to ask you if you have any pets. We already know you have Maria. And and so I want you to let my listeners know where they can get a copy of Saving Lucy, which is the American title, by the way. It is a different title in Europe and in the UK. And how to follow you on your blog.
Yeah, so I've got two blogs. One is worldbikegirl.com and the other one is ishbelholmes.com. And the worldbikegirl.com is about adventures and, you know, travel and street dogs. And ishbelholmes.com is more based on mental health. The book Saving Lucy is available right now in the USA, which is totally amazing. And you guys can get a copy of that from VeloPress.com, and they are my amazing publishers. But also it's available in all good bookstores as well, and sports shops stock it as well.
Well, Ishbel, I wish you so much luck. Have fun talking with your first minister tomorrow. And I will be waiting for your next book, and we will talk again.
Awesome. Thank you so much
for having me on. It's my pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And bye. Bye.
Ishbel Holmes joined me from Scotland. Tomorrow she meets the First Minister, which is akin to our president, and we'll be talking about mental health and street dogs. I hope you enjoyed my interview with her. I thought she was just fabulous. You can get a copy of her book if you're interested at Velo Press or on Amazon. It is called Saving Lucy. So we need to take a break, and then we'll be back to talk with Sean Coffey from Stages Cycling about the Stages Power Crank Arms. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
On The Outspoken Cyclist, I'm Diane Jenks, and we're off to Boulder, Colorado to speak with Sean Coffey, the global manager of outdoor cycling for StagesCycling.com. Hi, Sean. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure. Tell us a little bit about who you are, Mr. Stages Cycling.
Well, I'm the global marketing director for Stages Cycling on the outdoor side of things. So that's all the power meters and computers and other products related to that that we make for cycling outdoors.
Very cool. So, you know, this is our countdown to the gift giving season. We try to do a possible gift idea every week between now and around the 15th of December. And I thought maybe Stages would be a first good gift giving idea this year. What do you think?
Well, I think it's a good approach for anybody that's got a cyclist in their life. There are a lot of things you can buy cyclists that are great gifts, but there are few things that make as big of a difference in your cycling than having a power meter. So if you've got someone on your holiday list that doesn't already have a power meter, it's definitely worth considering over most other things, I think.
Tell us a little bit about the background of Stages. I can remember when we got the very first Stages left-hand crank arm in. It was many, many years ago now. For me, I've been retired since 2012, and I don't even remember when the company started, but I'm like, this is really kind of a cool thing.
We started in 2010, and most of the people that are at the company have a long legacy in the cycling and indoor fitness realm. And our first products weren't for normal outdoor bicycles. They were for indoor bikes. And we started really working in that area and brought power to indoor cycling first. And then figured out a way to effectively bring it to that left crank arm that we're all familiar with about 6 years ago now. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, wow. See, 2012, right around the time that I decided, okay, I've had enough of retail. So why do you think power has become such an important and popular thing to track? Why do people want to know power over, say, heart rate or cadence or anything like that?
Well, power is instantaneous and indisputable. Heart rate has been a metric for a long time, but heart rate is highly susceptible to interference from hydration, stress, caffeine, and it's also a relatively slow metric to respond. And that's not to say that we don't still value heart rate as a training metric as well. Heart rate and power combined is a very powerful tool. But power is an absolute. It's going to tell you how hard you're pushing or how hard you're not pushing at any given moment instantaneously. And in that regard, it's very effective for much shorter efforts. And it's also very effective for pacing and for gauging your effort over the longer course of a ride, say, when maybe hydration or heat or some other things might throw your heart rate off 5 or 10 beats and possibly confuse your effort to pace.
Hmm, interesting. So I know this has been explained to me before. Maybe you can give me a better explanation. What is a strain gauge?
Well, that's a great question, and I think engineers would probably spend the next 15 minutes explaining what that is. But long story short is it's a small piece of metal that is nested onto something, and based on the current that flows through it, I believe, it can measure minute amounts of flex and movement. And then you've got other electronic components that can translate that minute amount of flex into different valuable numbers.
Okay, that makes sense. I happen to be married to an engineer who's explained it to me in engineering terms more than once, but I got that, I think. I think I got that. Let me take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Sean Coffey. He's with Stages Cycling. We're talking about power meters as maybe something you want to add to your bike if you're interested, if you don't have one. And if you do, maybe you already know what the Stages are all about. So I remember Stages. Crank arms were non-drive side. Now do you track power on both crank and non-drive side?
We do, yes. We have a number of units which are left, right, or bilateral power measurement. One of the reasons why we wanted to introduce the left side first was that power meters are expensive, and we feel that it's really important to make this kind of technology not only accessible at lower price points so that we can get more riders on power, but also give them an accurate, reliable experience, even with only one side, which is what we succeeded at doing when we launched. That said, there are a number of high-level Tour de France caliber teams that want an even deeper experience in terms of pedal dynamics and also comparative data rider to rider that really is something that benefits a left-right system.
Got it. That makes sense. Do you get different readings left and right? I mean, well, obviously, you probably pedal differently left and right.
Most riders are very close to 50-50. And I think there's some cases where you might be a little bit left dominant or a little bit right dominant. But when it comes to your power reading, if it's just you and you're training and looking to improve, the most important thing, and this is what we spend a ton of time and energy and patents on, is making sure that your power is consistent, whether no matter which leg or both it's coming from, that it's consistent at the start of the ride as it is at the end of the ride, this week to next week, cold days to hot days. That's the most important thing, because you want to compare the work you did last month to the work you're doing this month. And your left-right balance doesn't tend to change over time unless you have an injury or something like that that complicates it.
Right. So do you need a specific kind of crank to use a Stages system?
Not really. I mean, there's always some outlier crank models that maybe we don't cover, but we have one of the broadest ranges of left side meters and also sizes and models. And we have right side as well. If you just want right side, if you have a gravel bike or an aero bike that has a brake mounted on the chainstay, you might have less clearance. So chances are very good that if you want a power meter, Stages has something that'll work with the bike that, and the crank that you have.
All right. So how does it work? What do you do? Let's say I want to order a Stages crank for my husband's Ultegra crank set.
Well, there's two ways to do it. In the spirit of the holidays, I'd recommend going to our website. We have gift certificates available on our website, and I would probably just purchase one of those. That might be a little bit easier, unless you're familiar with bikes and cranks enough that you can look at your spouse's or significant other's crank and identify what model and what length it is. Those are the two things that we need.
So what happens to the old crank part, whether it's left or right or both?
Well, that's a great question. We make everything here in Boulder, Colorado, and whenever possible, we work with riders locally and we work with teams to get their crank arms back. And we can basically put a crank arm, or we can put a power meter on your existing crank arm and then send it back to you. But that's a little bit more difficult to do on a broader consumer scale. So at this point, we're working on some sort of program for the future that might help us capture that. But it's something that, you know, right now you would take that left crank arm off and you'd replace it with a stager's crank arm with a power meter. And then that left would serve as a spare.
Aha. Aha. So you're not taking the left ones back and then turning them into power meters and then sending them back out?
We can only do that with some of the pro teams based on the volume. If we did that with the broader consumer base, it would be just too much shipping, and we can't always guarantee the condition of the crank arm when it comes to us. So when we work with teams, we get brand new crank arms and we can work with them. But if, say, if you took the crank arm off of your bike right now and sent it to us, we don't know for sure how many miles it's seen or how much life it has left in it. And it's a little bit more difficult for us to work with stuff like that.
All good points. All good points. So what happens when you buy a new bike? Can you take your existing stages crank and put it on your new bike?
Absolutely.
Okay. Okay. So what else is Stages offering besides crank arms? I know you have a computer. Is this all, I guess I really need to know how it works. Is it, it is wireless?
Yeah, it's a GPS-based computer, which is kind of the standard of most computers these days. So it measures speed and distance and time and things like that completely wirelessly. And it will also work with any brand of power meter, of course, including Stages. And it'll help you track as much or as little as you want to track on your ride. That's including heart rate, that could be calories, that could be a deep experience of different power readings and heart rate readings and pedal dynamics, or as little as you want. It's very configurable, which is something that we feel is important. I mean, people want to see the data they want to see, and they don't want to be overwhelmed with things that aren't valuable to them.
Right. And then you can upload that data to Strava or whatever service you use.
Very interesting. Absolutely.
So how can my listeners find out more about Stages?
Well, the easiest thing to do would be check us out on social media at Stages Cycling, or go to our website, stagescycling.com.
Well, thanks so much for taking time to talk with me today. I know you are probably heading into a busy time of year. We've been talking with Sean Coffey. He is the global marketing manager for outdoor cycling for Stages Cycling at stagescycling.com. Thanks. I hope you have a great holiday.
You too. Thanks very much for having me.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
My thanks to Sean Coffey. He's the global cycling manager for stagescycling.com for their outdoor products. If you're interested in the Stages power meters, you can log on to stagescycling.com, take a look at all the products. And as Sean suggested, if you have a cyclist in your life and you are interested in getting him or her a gift, you can get a gift certificate. I'd also, of course, like to thank Ishbel Rose Holmes for taking time to talk with me today about her book, Saving Lucy, A Girl, A Bike, and a Street Dog. The book is interesting. It's fascinating. It's a great read. And I hope Ishbel enjoyed her conversation with the First Minister of Scotland the day after I spoke with her. I haven't talked to her since. You can find out more about Ishbel and the work she's doing with street dogs and all of her adventures at worldbikegirl.com. Or learn more about the mental health issues that she is championing at ishbelholmes.com. I hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you so much for listening. Remember, you can always join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can leave us a comment at outspokencyclist.com or send us a tweet at outspokencyclist without an E. I'd like to remind you that the Outspoken Cyclist is a listener-sponsored podcast, so if you're interested in helping us out, you can leave a small donation at outspokencyclist.com. I hope you have a great week. Do not forget to set your clocks back this week, and if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.